to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
The North State recently lost a beloved supporter of the arts, and especially of the North State Symphony, Helga Ruge. In her honor, I would like to rebroadcast interviews I did with her for Nancy's Bookshelf. Helga Ruge's first book was a memoir, Flashbacks of a Diplomat's Wife. Later in the hour, we'll hear about her book, More Truth Than Fiction. The book, Flashbacks of a Diplomat's Wife, is a memoir by my guest today, Helga Ruge, but it's also a tribute to her late husband, former American Service Officer Neil Ruge. Welcome, Mrs. Ruge.
Thank you so much for having me, Nancy.
When did you realize you had to write this book?
Well, I was invited by a book club to talk about my life in the Foreign Service instead of just giving a book report, because most Americans don't know much about the Foreign Service and life in the Foreign Service. So I started preparing for this program, and I came up with about 40 pages, and I had a slideshow as well, and it was very well received. And I had questions about it, and so it developed from then on. And later on, when I had more time to write, I expanded on it, and I was able to ask questions of my husband. I had hoped he would cooperate with me and write about his side of the story and his life, but it was not to be. So, and then I found a wonderful editor, Ruth Younger, who worked with me and cleaned it up a little bit and asked questions. And I found a graphic artist who did the interior layout and a local printer. And so it really came to be.
So you have called Chico your home now for almost 40 years, but you had a home in many places before this, starting even as a child.
Yes, that's right. And that's what my last book, or the new book, is going to be about. It's more based on my childhood.
Because I think that is interesting that even before you became a diplomat's wife, your childhood actually was a preparation because you were lived in different cultures. Soviet Russia, for example,
yes,
as a child.
We visited my father there when he was sent there by his firm 3 years in a row for just, say, half a year each time. And then we also lived in Berlin for a year, always changed schools, and then finally went to Romania for 6 years before the war. So, and I studied languages, and I also had Latin in school, and English and French, and later on I studied Russian at the university level. Well, I don't remember much of it, because if you don't use it, you lose it.
So you were actually born in Germany, though,
yes,
in Wiesbaden.
Yes, I was born in Wiesbaden, yeah.
So German is your first language.
Yes, it's my first language.
And you're writing this book in a second language, but you had ample preparation, though, not just because you lived in different cultures, but also as a university student.
Yes. Well, you know, I've lived in this country longer than in any other country before, and I've been a citizen since 1950.
Well, your book begins in 1948, and this was really interesting because this actually is 3 years after you met this handsome U.S. Army captain named Neil Ruge.
Right.
And I think a lot of couples can identify with your circumstance in some regards, in that he first says, oh, I want to marry you, and then after a while he says, oh, well, let's be friends.
Yeah, well, because then, he was already had a law degree, but after the war, he took advantage of the GI Bill and went to Harvard Business School. And while he was there, he learned about the Foreign Service. And so he took an exam, and he passed, and they wanted him. And so he said, well, as a Foreign Service officer, I'm not allowed to marry a foreigner. So that was kind of a big shock. But of course, we didn't know whether we'll ever see each other again when he left in 45. But fortunately, it all worked out for the best.
So after this, you didn't know from the long distance what was going to happen.
It was a roller coaster.
One minute he would say, yes, I want to marry, and the next minute,
let's be friends, yeah.
Yeah. So when did you get married?
Well, we got married in Palermo in 1949.
Because that was where he was first posted.
Yes,
to
that was his
Sicily.
First post, and I left Germany in March 49 when there was still no German government. There was still in a military occupation.
Yeah.
So I had to have a military exit permit, and I had to have an Italian visa. And Neil said, well, you're coming down on the train. You might as well stop along the way and do some sightseeing.
Mm-hmm. Because he loved that himself.
He loved. He was an inveterate sightseer. Yeah. And so Italy and Sicily, of course, was a wonderful place to go sightseeing and see all these wonderful temples and also, of course, wonderful coastline and beaches. And
not to mention romantic for a young married couple.
Very romantic, yeah.
Well, your next posting, too, was so interesting. I've always found North Africa fascinating, maybe because I like Camus, the Stranger.
Yes.
But you were in Morocco.
Yes, our next post was Casablanca, Morocco.
Yeah.
At that time, it was still French protectorate. So the official language there was French. Now, fortunately, I'd had 8 years of high school French and was able to communicate.
And the fact that it was a French protectorate had implications for your husband's role there.
Oh, yes. I think the main reason he was transferred to Casablanca was because the consul general requested an officer who would also be a lawyer, because in Morocco we still at that time had extraterritorial rights, which meant that American citizens who got into trouble with the law could not be sued in a French or a Moroccan court, but only in the consular court. And, you know, when my husband first started his job, he complained to the consul general that there wasn't enough work to do. There weren't too many Americans living there getting into trouble. And then suddenly found out that our government had arranged to have air bases built in Morocco, and 10,000 construction workers from the United States descended on Morocco, nearby Casablanca,
and they built were capable the of getting in
and
a lot
they
of trouble.
Got into a lot of trouble. I mean, from simple drunkenness to attempted murder and all sorts of things. So when this happened, then when they were replaced by the Air Force personnel, there was another 10,000 there, and they had different problems, legal problems, and there was child custody cases and things like that, divorces and what have you.
So he first, when he arrives there, thinks, I don't have enough to do.
And then, I mean, it got so busy that President Truman appointed a former attorney general, I think from Mexico, Judge Helmick, to be the judge, and Neil was the prosecutor. And they,
well, in the process of living there in Morocco, you got to get to know Arab culture.
Oh, yes.
And both on the formal level and informally.
Right.
And I think the dinner you described is very interesting when you give the hierarchy.
The Difa, yes. Well, this gentleman, he was a protege of the consular court. And when Neil arrived, he gave a dinner in his honor, a Difa. And he invited the whole consulate, not just the officers, but the staff, even down to the messengers and the drivers. So, and invited some of the French officials, like the chief of police. And so it was a fascinating evening. I've written a couple of pages about this.
Yeah, and the hierarchy was that the guest, of course, eat first.
Yes, the guests eat first, and the host just supervises the servants and makes sure that the guests are comfortable. Although he had four wives, they did not appear, because in mixed company, that's not done.
Don't socialize together.
They don't socialize together with strangers anyway. Mm-hmm. And then when we were all done with the food, then later on, the host will eat with his wives, and then what was left again, and I'm sure there was a lot left, then the servants would eat. And
in fact, you had quite a household of servants to manage yourself.
Yes,
when you lived
I think
Morocco.
Actually, it was just the custom to have servants. So, although I didn't need them that badly, we had a Fatima, and we had a cook, a male cook, and we had a gardener. And sometimes we had two maids, Fatimas, and there was even tension between them. You know, there were even cultural differences and even racial differences between them. Mm-hmm. You know, some were pure Arab, some were mixed, with other races, and so they mm-hmm. didn't always get along.
So you had to be diplomatic with your household.
Oh, yes. But I also had a wedding in my house. My Fatima, my longtime Fatima, she went against the grain, and she picked her own husband instead of having the family pick the husband. Mm-hmm. And so they disowned her. And so the wedding was in our house, and the entrance, there was just a huge entrance hall, and the groom's women did all the preparations for her. And
because her family refused to do it.
I said, well, I hope we didn't influence her.
Well, then you did have a rather distinguished visitor to Morocco while you were there,
Sir Winston Churchill. Yes. Oh, may I just read that little passage there? So between Christmas and New Year's, the in place to go to escape the rain was sunny Marrakesh below the Atlas Mountains. So we went, still unencumbered by children, to spend the few days at the famous Mamounia Hotel. The Place El Jemaa El Fna had 1,000 attractions, not only for curious tourists, but also for the Arab and Berber population of the interior. Camel drivers, nomads, merchants, and farmers would exchange their wares, cluster around gesticulating storytellers, or watch the charismatic snake charmers put their cobras through their ritual dances. Water carriers sold water from their goatskins, poured it into shiny brass cups, wiped them dry, and served the next customer. They possessed only 2 cups each. At the hotel, we had the great fortune to share the same dining room with Sir Winston Churchill and his party, not the same table, however. Neil, who was facing Churchill directly, had a better view than I. He was the only gentleman wearing a navy corduroy jacket and an open collar shirt and artist's outfit. All the other guests were in formal attire. Churchill could get away with it. He had made history. And we learned that Marrakesh was Churchill's favorite winter resort, where he painted pictures of camels and local scenery and dictated his memoirs. And, he'd walk through the lobby and with his famous cigar and nodding at everyone, you know. And I would have loved to have asked him for an autograph, but Neil wouldn't have it.
No, I think that was the wiser choice.
Yes. Oh, yes. He was very, very protocolish, you know.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of interviews with author and former diplomat's wife, Helga Ruge, who died this past January 25th. So after your stay in Morocco, mm-hmm. where you see Casablanca and Marrakesh, and then you go home for Neil, for your family after that. And it takes, I think people don't realize, it took 20 hours to get from Paris to New York when you came back that first time.
Well, he really crossed me there. I would have loved to have gone by ship because we were still entitled to go. Even in a minimum first class, but it was still wonderful. No, but he thought with a youngster it would be easier to fly. But in those days, we didn't have jet airplanes yet. That was in about 51, 52. And so we flew from Casablanca to Bordeaux, and then we flew from Bordeaux to Paris, and we overnighted. Then we got onto these Stratos cruisers, and we had bunks even up above. That was unusual.
It made me nostalgic for when airline travel used to be civilized.
More I can't even think of the English word right now, the hangamatta, the hammocks, And so Neil had it to himself, and of course I, with my 13-month-old baby, I didn't sleep very well, and we had to refuel twice before we got to New York, to find out that the hotel where we thought we had a reservation didn't have one until Carl started screaming, and all of a sudden they found it.
And Carl, we might remind, is the son,
Carl youngster. Carl is our son, the youngster. He was born in Casablanca.
You're there. So the three of you came back and spent some time here in the United States, and then your next posting was England.
Yes, it was London. It was, a safe place because, the last year in Morocco, things got really difficult. The War of Liberation had started, and I narrowly escaped a bomb attack in the meat market and almost Christmas Eve.
It was interesting. You said that you normally would have been at that market later, but that morning, because it was Christmas Eve, you went a little bit earlier?
I went a half an hour earlier to beat the crowds. And
that probably saved your life.
It saved my life, because when I came home, my husband called and said, "Are you all right?" And I thought, oh, funny, he doesn't call me every day to find out if I'm all right. And I said, yes. And he said, thank God, because a bomb had just gone off in the meat market, which was enclosed where I had shopped, and 20 people were killed. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't among them, thank God.
So there was unrest in Morocco.
Yeah.
So
yes.
That was a good time to be,
to be
leaving to
going
somewhere.
To London.
To London. You know, well, you were in London for a while, and then you went to Wales.
Yes. Neil enjoyed this post a great deal. He was the big fish, you know, there. He was the consul for Wales and Monmouthshire, and Wales is a large area to cover, and he traveled a lot. He made a lot of speeches. Even I was invited to make speeches, and remember even a Pakistani group who was friendly with my German housekeeper. She went to the English-speaking union to study English. They had invited me to hoist their flag at their Pakistani national holiday, and then in the evening they had a bazaar and speeches, and so Neil was invited to make a speech, and it was very interesting. There were a lot of different duties that even wives could perform, but in those days, wives were really not allowed to work outside. Mm-hmm. You know, we were just being hostesses and doing all these other good things.
So after England, London, and you had quite an estate, but it was a little difficult because Neil had a long commute when you lived on this 15-acre estate outside London.
Yes, but it was within our housing allowance, and we were looking for a house that had central heating because I was expecting our second child. It turned out to be a girl, Madeline. And we also had a German Shepherd who had to be in quarantine for 6 months, you know, in Britain in that time.
Yeah.
Now it's changed, I think. And so we finally found this place after living in a hotel for 6 weeks. And it was a beautiful place. And I had a lawn tennis court. Of course, we didn't use it. And I had shrubs. This former landlord who was some lord, he had traveled all over the world and collected shrubbery and trees. And so it was just blooming all over. And then in the spring, the daffodils were just wild. I had just vases full of flowers.
So it's a beautiful place for you to be.
But it was a lonely place for me because I just had Carl and the dog, and that was it. And I had maybe once a week I had a woman to come in and do the heavy cleaning. And it was about 12 hours on my own. I wouldn't want to repeat that. So we were there only 1 year, and then we went to Cardiff, which was a delightful place.
And then when your next post, it seems like people would think, oh, Washington, D.C., that sounds like a good place to be. But you call that chapter Hardship Post.
Yeah, well, financially it was a hardship post. And in many other ways, climate-wise, you know, in the summer it was extremely hot and humid and no air conditioning in those days. And in the winters, they'd have severe snowfall suddenly, like just the night before the Kennedy inauguration. I know it normally took my husband half an hour on the bus to get to the State Department from where we were in Arlington. That night, it took him 4 hours to get home, walked across the Memorial Bridge. So in that respect, but I had to learn to become a housewife without help, and learn to cook properly. But fortunately, the children's elementary school was practically next door. That was also a property we just rented with 3 acres of land around it. We apparently liked some land around ourselves. And that just merged into the children's playground there. So that was easy. We were at the dead end, so they didn't have to cross any streets. And it was wonderful.
Well, while you were there in Washington, that was an interesting time. You did get to see St. Patrick's Day Parade, a distinguished...
Oh, yes. I saw Eisenhower and the Irish president floating down the street in an open car.
In those days, that could be true.
And when I did some volunteer work at the State Department, that was when President Kennedy was in office, he gave his press conferences at the State Department auditorium because the White House didn't have anything big enough. Mm-hmm. And I know we weren't supposed to, go there, but I walked closer to where it was. They had the the Secret Service had had sort of screens there, but I looked through the screen and I could just see him before he entered. He whipped out his comb and he combed his hair. But he was terrific, you know. In fact,
there was the downfall of the hat industry.
Absolutely, yeah. During the inauguration, yeah, in that ice cold, day, he still didn't wear it. But he had a lot of hair, so that helped.
Well, there was somebody that you also ran into, so to speak, in Washington that I was particularly interested in, and this was a French singer. And as soon as I saw the name, I thought, "Oh, la mer!"
Yeah, la mer. Yeah,
that song came to my mind as soon as I read his name.
It was Charles Trenet.
Yeah, yes. And when I read on in your book, I mean, not only did you go to this concert, but you actually encountered him, and you and your husband said, "Oh, we're so sorry you haven't sung La Mer."
La Mer, yeah. It was actually at one of the hotels, and he was entertaining, and there was dancing. And then during the break, you know, we worked on, by that time he hadn't sung La Mer yet, and that was my husband's favorite. You know, he had heard him in Casablanca when he was there giving a concert, and he raved about him. And so we saw him when Neil introduced himself and said who he was and that he had heard him before, and he was so sorry he hadn't. So he just, right there for the two of us, he sang La Mer just to us, you know, without any accompaniment. That was wonderful.
Well, yeah. I think, too, listeners who don't think they're familiar with this tune might remember Bobby Darin made it very popular, Somewhere Beyond the Sea.
Yeah, well,
that's
the English.
Tune. Yeah,
that's
English.
English language.
So that was interesting. Francophile that I am, I enjoyed that little anecdote that you told.
Yes. Oh, yes. And
then Neil was a very valuable employee, if that's the word I want to use, because of the fact that he was a lawyer. He had experience as in military intelligence when he was in the Army.
Yes.
And he also had top secret clearance.
Yes.
And while you're in Washington, he also got a special honor as a lawyer. And I don't think he ever used this privilege that he had.
Oh yes, you're alluding to his becoming a
Supreme Court.
I mean, he was introduced to the Chief Justice. At that time, it was Warren.
Earl Warren.
Earl Warren, who welcomed him and said, since they both went to, I think, Bolt Hall,
Berkeley.
Berkeley. As a lawyer, so he was able to practice before the Supreme Court, but he never, of course, took advantage of it.
But he had the privilege.
Yeah,
should the occasion arise, he could have
gone to
the Supreme Court as an attorney. Mm-hmm. So next you go to, there was an interesting thing, too, when you're shipping your car to Munich, you didn't pay protection. It was only $25, but you didn't think you needed that.
Well, and we didn't even know about it. But, I mean, when we got to what was it? Well, anyway, when the car was
offloaded,
I think that was in Holland, and we were going to drive first to my parents and then to Munich. The brakes didn't work, and they may have had a terrible squeak on one side. There was some bashed in by the, so we were able to just barely get to a garage where they found out that, that they'd been deliberately damaged before the transport. So sometime
later.
Because
this is something I kind of expect in other cultures that, for example, when we lived in South America and you go to a restaurant, you have your car parked, and if you don't pay the little boy there to cuidar your car, then you might come back with a scratch.
Well, we're just naive. We didn't know. He probably would have done it for the sake of the health of the car. But it got all fixed, and it didn't cost us at all very much. It was really interesting.
So from your hardship post in Washington, D.C., you went to your ideal post in Munich, and you had many adventures. I just, I think readers would really enjoy all the interesting things that happened to you while you were in Munich.
Well, I would need another hour.
One thing that makes your book interesting, too, is that we know historical facts of the time, but you have the personal side. What was going on in your own life with this as the backdrop?
Oh.
Like the Cuban Missile Crisis came up when you were in Munich.
We arrived in the 1st of September of 62 in Munich, and Neil was, his title was Consul and Deputy Principal Officer. That meant he was the executive officer and next to the Consul General. And turned out that he was in charge immediately. Within 3 weeks, he was in charge of this huge outfit because the consul general was called back to the State Department. He had a special job to do for 3 months. And then the missile crisis came up. And is that right? And I've never seen my husband so concerned and so, you know, but poor,
preoccupied. Well, preoccupied, I think people would think, well, you are far away from the danger over here.
Yes.
But I was surprised. He was saying you had ration
boxes
and evacuation
plans, et cetera. And, you know, he was not only responsible for the staff at the consulate general, but also for all the civilian Americans in Bavaria. And in those days, there were 8,000 of them. And they had to be, you know, concerned about their safety. And of course, there was also a big military post there, but they had their own security. He didn't have to deal with that. And so he just did what he could. And fortunately, you know, President Kennedy had the cool head and it was resolved peacefully.
But
it was a very stressful first few, you know, introduction to his new post there. But after that, it just got to be, you know, extremely enjoyable.
And when you got to host all sorts of interesting people
came
to Munich.
Yes, and I got involved quite soon with the German American Women's Club, which was founded just shortly after the war. And they had their big fundraisers, and that funded scholarships, exchange scholarships between German and American students. And of course, Munich had a big university too.
But you, for example, got to meet famous astronaut back in the days when astronauts
everybody
heroes.
Wanted to come to Munich because in those days, you know, that was still, you know, divided. The country was divided. Bonn was sort of a sleepy little town, although it was the capital at that time. But Munich was considered the secret capital. It was also the city with heart, you know, and they loved to celebrate. So Neil and I, we met some very interesting people. John Glenn came with his wife. He gave a lecture at the America House and showed his slides. There was a luncheon by the Lord Mayor in his honor, to which we were invited. I went with his wife to Lodenfrei, one of the nicest stores with Bavarian costumes, and she bought one of the cute journals and a reception for them. But, you know, the secret that nobody knew at the time, but later on they talked openly about it, was that his wife was a stutterer rather badly, and she could not, you know, talk to other people without. So I stuck to her like glue to, you know, make sure that she was comfortable. And later on, I know, years later, I saw her on TV. She had apparently taken, you know, therapy, et cetera, and she could speak quite well. Uh-huh. But he was very protective and charming, really charming.
Well,
and we had Linda Bird Johnson. She was actually the private guest of Ambassador McGee and Mrs. McGee and Bonn.
Because while you were there too, the president was shot. President Kennedy was shot.
Oh, that was so traumatic because the Germans just loved, you know, President Kennedy. And you know, everybody knew where they were when that happened. We were at a sort of a gathering at one of the consul's residences when one of the consular officers who came a bit later informed us that it couldn't be true, but he just heard over the radio that he said, President Kennedy has been shot. And but at that time, we didn't know how serious it was. And so there was our consul general at the time. He was very fluent in German. You know, he received, you know, all the mourners officially, and he gave a speech right in front of them. And they had a torchlight ceremony and all that, yeah.
After a break, we'll learn more about the life of North State supporter of the arts, Helga Ruge, who died a little over a month ago. Previously, I talked to her about her second book, More Truth Than Fiction. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Welcome back to a rebroadcast of an interview with Helga Ruge, who died on January 25th of this year. In the past, I talked to her about her book, More Truth Than Fiction. As a child, Helga Ruge lived for a while in Russia and Berlin before spending her teenage years in Romania. In 1949, she married Neil Ruge, a United States Foreign Service officer, and accompanied him to Italy, North Africa, England, Germany, and Guatemala. After Neil retired from the Foreign Service and became a business law professor at Chico State University, that was in 1969, Helga earned a bachelor's degree and taught German for 9 years. Her first book was a memoir, Flashbacks of a Diplomat's Wife, and her third book, More Truth Than Fiction, is a novel based on her childhood growing up in Europe between the world wars. Helga Ruge, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
For listeners who haven't read your first book, they must be wondering, how did she get from Germany and end up in Chico?
Well, it's quite a roundabout trip, but I'm happy to be here now. But that was Neil's last post before he retired, Guatemala City. And in 1968, and as many know, the situation in Central America was pretty tense in those days.
And pretty typically unstable.
Well, yes, more or less. Sometimes more, sometimes less. But what really, he had a 3-year assignment. We were there from March, and in the middle of summer, suddenly, something pretty terrible happened, that our ambassador was assassinated right in the middle of the day and about a block or two from my husband's office, the consulate. And then we found out that my husband was put on the assassination list. The embassy has feelers in all sorts of directions.
In fact, weren't you asked to inform the ambassador's wife of what happened to him?
Yes, as soon as you know, I was invited to a tea party by a Guatemalan lady, and just pulled up in front of her house when a black embassy limousine pulled up on the opposite side, and out walked my husband looking ashen gray and said, you know, something terrible has happened. And I thought that it might have happened something to our children. But he said, no, the ambassador was assassinated. And I was asked to get Mrs. Krebs, who was the wife of the number two officer at the embassy, and see Mrs. Mean and inform her of this terrible tragedy. So I went to her house. She had just undergone a surgery and was still resting, put on some clothes, went over there. And the minute, and it was a terrible assignment to do that, and the minute we walked in there, she was already in the hallway or in the foyer and said, I know. And we said, how do you know? He said, and a reporter called her up and said, is it true that your husband has just been assassinated? Mm-hmm. So we just couldn't believe the insensitivity of these people. Mm-hmm. Well, of course, it was a shock went around the world. He was the first ambassador ever to have been assassinated.
So then your husband is...
My husband, yeah. So we had to have police protection, all that, and the chargé d'affaires, who was also a friend of his, was a classmate of his from the first day in the Foreign Service, said, well, you better think about it. You know, only have a couple of years here, and then you retire. Do you want to retire now or not? Anyway, we finally came to the conclusion, for the children's sake, it would be better to... retire now.
Take early retirement.
Let them finish the school year, which was in late October. And then we took off in our little Mercedes, full packed to the hill, and drove all through Mexico and did sightseeing. And it was wonderful. Got to Los Altos to my sister-in-law's just in time for Christmas.
So your husband had threats on his life.
Yes, he
and
did.
He could either choose to stay a couple more years under those circumstances or retire. And he really wanted to teach anyway, didn't he?
Yes, he did. And I didn't want to live a young widow the rest of my life and the children, you know, without a father. And so we found out when the vice consul visited us about 6 months later that they had also abducted the German ambassador. And since the government did not, negotiate with terrorists, they killed him. And so we knew that they would have killed Neil, too. Mm-hmm. And it was a good decision. And that's how we, wound up in Chico, because they offered him a position as a, business law professor. And everyone has been very supportive ever since.
Even because you've lived here in Chico for 40 years or more.
Yes. It's a lifetime for me.
But and during that time, though, you made a lot of friends. So when you did go through the death of your husband 10 years ago, you had that community support.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was wonderful. I'd written a couple of the books sort of informally before, but that gave me the impetus afterwards to revise them and get an editor to help me with the books. My friends have all been very supportive.
Well, I might mention that the story you told about how he concluded his career as a Foreign Service officer from Guatemala City, and you came to Chico. Mm-hmm. So those stories are in your first book, which is Flashbacks of a Diplomat's
That's
Wife.
Right. Yeah.
My guest, by the way, for listeners, is Helga Ruge, and we're going to be talking about her newest book, More Truth Than Fiction. It happens to be her third book, and it's actually a novel, but as the title says, there's a lot of truth in it. And Helga, as I was reading it, I was almost feeling like I was reading a roman à clé, because I was saying, now she names this child Helen, but I bet that's her. That's Helga.
That's true.
And then the sister in the story is named Inga.
Yeah.
But you dedicate your book to your sister, Elsa.
Ilse. Yeah.
Ilse.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, okay, so Inga is Ilse.
Yeah. Well, they sort of sounded similar.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's why I figured out who they were.
Uh-huh.
So you changed the names of your characters and the family, but the stories ring true.
That's true. Maybe I can read a paragraph or two from my reflections or preface.
The very first page in your
book. Because that kind of sets the mood. Yeah,
yeah, and that explains how you came to write this book the way you did.
I had a wonderful childhood. The memories linger on. As I reflect in my advanced age, my life unfolds much like a novel, with beginning, middle, and an uncertain end. This has inspired me to not only leave an account of my childhood for my family, but to share with readers everywhere what life was like in Europe during the early 1900s. Although every family has its very own history, different from all others, I believe that each offers a glimpse into the culture and character of an entire people. In that sense, my story can be viewed as unique yet universal. The many events and experiences I write about are factual, and though their names are fictitious, the human beings in my story are very real. And because I find autobiography without dialogue dead and boring, I give voice to these people even though it's not possible to recall exact words spoken so many decades ago. Some pronouncements of my parents, grandmother, sister, and friends are genuine. Others capture what I imagine the person to have said in a certain situation.
And Helga's reading from her book, More Truth Than Fiction. It's growing up in Europe between the world wars. And Helga, I was so interested in your story, too, because in my own family, my sister-in-law was born during this time that you write about, between the world wars. And I've often wondered what her life was like, and I've never known exactly the questions to ask. And so your book has given me a feeling for what life must have been like in Europe when she was growing up. She was born in Austria, so German is her first language, like it is yours.
Yes.
But you you mentioned that you were born in Wiesbaden, but you don't call it that in your book.
Well, it's Wiesbaden-Biebrich, actually. That's just the part of Wiesbaden which is directly on the Rhine River. And was a small town with a beautiful city park that used to be part of a Schloss, which is directly on the Rhine River. And believe it or not, and I went to Trader Joe's recently, I found out there is a champagne that's called Schloss Biebrich. If you haven't tried it yet, it's not bad. Well, it didn't exist in those days. That happened after I left. And it's all been restored, so it looks beautiful. But We enjoyed the life there very much. And the school, the grammar school, was in the same street. We lived in the Goethestrasse, of course. as our apartment. We lived in apartments mostly. We didn't own houses in those days, and so it was just a hop, skip, and a jump to school. And I loved school because we had an excellent teacher who was very, very fair. And there's some fun stories and remembrances.
Well, the other characters, in your book, is you and your sister. Mm-hmm. In the story, they're Helen and Inga.
Yes.
And your parents in the story
are Peter and Lisa. Heimbach. Yeah.
And then there are also a couple of other characters, and I was brought back fond memories for me because one was, you call her Omi.
My own mother
was Oma to some of her grandchildren.
Omi is still more of a
familiar form.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also there was Tanta.
Yeah, Tanta, that's aunt.
And that's, I'm Tanta Nancy to a couple of nieces.
Yes, I had a Tanta Sabina and Omi, that was
in your story.
Yeah, yeah. Only on my father's side, I had a grandmother. My father, his father died early, and my mother was an orphan when she was 16 already. Only child.
Well, your father worked for a pharmaceutical company, so he had a good job, but still, the situation was a little difficult. And you tell a story when you were a child of these neighbors said, you know what, Lisa, talking to your mother, you know, you should get some ducks and a pig. And so your mother is a young wife then, and she thought, well, yeah, that's a good idea. And so off she goes to the market to get some ducks.
Yes.
And why don't you read that
story? Shall I read that story?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. One morning as they met in the staircase, Martha, this is the neighbor, said to Lisa, if you want to fill your larder, dear girl, you'd better get yourself a pig and a few ducks. The ducks don't need much, and the pig can live off your leftovers, as if they did have any. The tool shed can double up as a sty, and the men can dig a little pond in the garden. Lisa, the wide-eyed city girl, was incredulous at such boldness. Do you really think we could do this? She asked. Why, of course, there's nothing to it. My folks always kept a few pigs, chickens, and goats at home. I grew up with animals, so you can rely on my advice. Just make sure we still have enough garden left for the vegetables, said Martha. So the Heimbachs set out one morning to shop for ducks at the open market in the neighboring town. They walked for miles along the Rhine River with large shopping bags dangling from their elbows. From time to time, they would pass French and Senegalese soldiers on patrol. They were just, occupied at that time by the French.
Yeah, in fact, you, as you're telling this more or less through the eyes of a child, your eyes, actually, you don't go into a lot of the political situation, just kind of, because you probably, that young, you wouldn't have understood it at that point anyway.
No.
But just for the readers, you might
mention. Yeah, for the readers, I did set it into a timeline, a background, And some of the stories that I still remember hearing from my parents, Well, this, of course, happened before I was born even, I incorporated that. So
they're on their way to market to buy some ducks.
Yeah. When they reached their destination, they had little trouble locating ducks at a market stall. They purchased two, proudly tucked them into the bags with only their heads sticking out, and without any delay, walked to the nearest streetcar stop. The bags were much heavier now, so when Lisa showed signs of fatigue after the long walk, Peter had decided they could afford the luxury of a ride home. So they saved the one ride for walking.
On the way back.
On the way back. Although it wasn't expensive, they still had to count the pennies, I'll be so glad when we get home. I'm hungry as well as tired, said Lisa. So I am, said Peter. I could go for a liverwurst sandwich and a beer, but here comes the streetcar. No sooner had the conductor laid eyes on their precious cargo than he said sternly, no animals are allowed on this streetcar. You must get off at the next stop. They're harmless. They won't hurt anybody, Herr Schaffner, that means Mr. Conductor, said Peter Heimbach. Regulations must be observed, replied the official, blocking the entrance to the carriage interior. Can't we buy two extra tickets for the ducks? Asked Lisa with her most engaging smile. Regulations laid down by the authorities don't allow for exceptions, lady. He's a real Prussian bureaucrat, thought Lisa. So human considerations must be as alien to him as abstract concepts would be to an Indian in the Amazon jungle. As if to prove her point, the officious conductor expedited Heimbach off the platform as soon as the streetcar came to a halt. Peter felt like setting the ducks free on the shore of the Rhine River, but Lisa would not hear of it. Instead, she got a hold of two cardboard boxes, stocked the birds inside, tied strings around them, poked a few holes in the top and in the sides, and placed the boxes in the bags. About an hour had elapsed since their expulsion from the streetcar, and they were even more hungry and anxious to get home. When the next streetcar arrived, they quickly mounted the platform, stepped inside, and sat down with their shopping bags tucked between their knees, eyes glued to the boxes inside. Suddenly, two sturdy legs clad in blue trousers planted themselves in front of the Heimbach, and a familiar voice said coolly, "Ah, there you are again." Lisa and Peter looked up and were dumbstruck to see their nemesis, the Prussian conductor. Both stifled groans. "Two single tickets to Biebrich, please," said Peter, without looking the fellow in the eye. The man in the blue uniform scrutinized the bags, from which a few stifled quacks emanated. Lisa squirmed and was about to defend her boldness when the Prussian, with a tiny twinkle in his eye, handed her husband the tickets. "Now I don't see what's in those boxes," he said quietly, before adding a hearty, "I wish you a good day." He raised his hand to his visor hat and moved on. Peter pulled out a handkerchief and mopped his brow. Lisa's sigh of relief, mingled with peculiar scratching noises emanating from the shopping bags, drew amused looks from their fellow passengers. "Good for you," a motherly woman whispered in Lisa's ear. "You're learning to play the game. You must, you know, if you want to survive."
My guest is Helga Ruge, and she's reading from her novel, More Truth Than Fiction, Growing Up in Europe Between the World Wars. And this story, since you were saying you were not even born then,
no,
to this story, but you must have heard the family telling this story about the
ducks. Oh, yes, many times, and then the pig, too, and when they finally... The pig even escaped once, and my mother used to put me out in a baby carriage in the garden there, for fresh air. Germans were much for fresh air. But with one of those old-fashioned high ones with a hood, et cetera, and she was looking out the window, and suddenly she noticed the pig had gotten under my baby carriage and had knocked it backwards, though. So that was the end of the life of the pig. That pig had to go.
You know what? You mentioned the Germans liking the fresh air. When my sister-in-law came to the United States, mm-hmm. and my niece was young at the time, so she took her out in the carriage and took her for a walk. And mm-hmm. The only other mother she encountered doing that was
another German mother.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, your story, of course, begins in Germany.
Yeah.
But then, since your father worked for a company that was international,
yes,
you got to go to, well, to me it sounds exciting, but yeah. I'll ask you whether you felt it was. You got to go to Moscow.
Yes. And that's where I took some literary license or poetic license, mm-hmm. because we were only allowed to visit my father for 6 months at a time, and then 3 years in a row. My sister was two, I was four when we came the first year, but I just wrote about it as if it were just a one continuous mm-hmm. visit, because
yeah.
that would have chopped it up too much.
Yeah.
And so we were, I guess the company put us into a house that was a former grand mansion that was divided up into many small apartments or even just rooms. And ours, as I remember my parents telling me, was shared with a couple of other German colleagues of my father's. And
So the accommodations were quite adequate.
But barely adequate,
Considering
very
the
crowded,
possibility.
Yeah, very crowded.
However, you had an experience that most Americans would find very unpleasant.
Oh, yes.
and that is your mother discovered lice.
Yes. And that's how she discovered it, was when she came home from standing in line for hours just for a couple of oranges. She found a comb on the kitchen table that was, at closer inspection, was just crawling with things. And they had a maid they shared, a Russian maid, Natasha. And she said, "Natasha, She called her, and Natasha wandered in, scratching her head, puzzled by the fuss Mrs. Heimbach kicked up over one lousy comb. "Tell me if what I'm suspecting is correct. Are those creepy things lies from your head by any chance?" Lisa shrieked. "Yes, Frau Heimbach," said the maid, shrugging her shoulders. "Almost everybody has them. You just have to learn to live with them, you know." "My God, the children. I've got to check the children," says Lisa's hands.
The children up. Meaning you and your sister.
Yes, well, or in the story,
Helen and Inga.
Helen and Inga, yeah. Lisa's hands flew up to her own head, and she began to scratch her scalp while calling the girls. They came running as if the house were on fire. "What's going on, Mama? What are you so excited about?" "Let me see your hair, first Inga and then Helly." Examining her daughter's heads with trembling hands, Lisa soon confirmed her suspicions. "Oh, my God, they have them, too. I've just found lots of tiny eggs," she cried out, shuddering. As she crushed one between her fingernails, she heard a crisp popping sound. "What am I going to do? How do I get rid of these horrible creatures? I never dreamed this could happen to us." And then finally her husband came home, and I just cut it short a little bit. And he says, "Well, don't get so excited. It's not a disgrace catching lice. It's no fun, I grant you, but the sky's not falling down either. I'll send Natasha to the pharmacist. There may be shortages of almost everything, but I guarantee you there's plenty of lice-killing solution around." So he kissed his dejected wife and hugged the children, then quickly walked over to the mirror in the hallway and ran his own comb through his dark hair. When no one was looking, he held it up against the light before putting it back in his breast pocket. Apparently, he was satisfied they didn't have it.
Well, now, Helga, do you remember this?
Yeah, that I remember.
And you remember the lice in your hair?
Oh, yes.
Now,
yes.
Had you felt any symptoms or maybe?
Well, I just can't remember that anymore. I just know that, you know, when my mother
But your mother got very
hair,
upset.
Yes, and every time she found one of those eggs, she popped them between her nails, and they did make a crisp sound.
Oh,
and then the solutions, you know, that... That they used the smell to high heaven and were, you know, really quite harsh.
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
They also treated Natasha because after all she was
the spreader.
They may have also caught it from the children they played with, you know. Uh-huh. They played with local children.
But Natasha was a likely source of
right there, yeah.
Well, and these weren't the only little creepy crawly things your mother discovered in this apartment.
Oh, no. And then suddenly... strange welts appeared on everybody's skin, causing almost unbearable itching. Peter consulted his neighbor and colleague, Mr. Ritter, who was an old Russian hand. Sure enough, what Peter had suspected was correct. The welts were bedbug bites. Now, hunting for elusive bedbugs became Lisa's newest sport. The poor janitor of this once magnificent mansion solved his bug problem by periodically boiling huge quantities of water, then slopping it on the walls and over the iron bedsteads, and there were many for his family of 12 children. This method would be effective for a short while, but the creatures were extremely resilient. Even a Russian winter couldn't kill them. Fumigation seemed to help some. It was mostly a case of coexistence and combination for the Heimbachs and the bedbugs. Well, those are some of the unpleasant things, but we did have one, you know, very scary story, what I call the Bell story.
My guest is Helga Ruge, and she's reading from her book, More Truth Than Fiction. It's a novelized account of her growing up in Europe between the world wars, and she chose to make it a novel so that she could use dialogue, even though she, of course, couldn't recall the exact words that were spoken. You've been listening to a rebroadcast of interviews with author and former diplomat's wife, Helga Ruge, who died this past January 25th. I've invited the book reviewer for the Chico Enterprise Record to update us on e-newsletters.
Email newsletters seem to be proliferating. I'd like to recommend two devoted to literature. The first is called Proof Rock, PRUFROCK, subtitled Books, Arts, Ideas, a daily newsletter maintained by conservative writer Micah Mattox. He's an assistant professor of literature at Houston Baptist University. The title of the newsletter is taken from that famous poem by T.S. Eliot, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, one of the key works of modernist poetry. There is lament here. The poet asks, "Do I dare disturb the universe? In a minute there is time for decisions and revisions, which a minute will reverse." The poem begins with an epigraph from Dante's Inferno and includes references to Shakespeare, the metaphysical poet John Donne, and the Bible. The newsletter Proofrock curates a miscellany of links about culture, with suitable excerpts to entice the reader. A recent newsletter contained links to a history of mid-century British dance halls, an article about the lingering health effects of the U.S. Civil War, reflections on teaching Greek, evidence that learning styles don't exist, and articles on how to save literary studies, the historiography of Tacitus, and a review of reviewer Michael Derda's new book called Browsings. Each edition of the newsletter includes a link to a poem and an image of the day, and notice of a forthcoming book such as David's Sling, A History of Democracy in 10 Works of Art. For the link to subscribe, go to micahmattix.com, micahmattix.com. From the progressive and experimental side of literature comes Lit Hub Daily, a partnership of independent publishers Grove Atlantic and Electric Literature. The nonprofit Electric Lit delivers a free short story each week, and the site maintains that, quote, "The transformative experience of reading literature fosters empathy and explores the human condition like no other art form," end quote. The newsletter Lit Hub Daily calls its links the best of the literary internet. It draws on hundreds of online sources from The New Yorker and NPR to TriQuarterly, Hazlitt, Entropy, and Dive Dapper. The links in recent Lit Hub Daily newsletters point to articles on fan-designed covers for the 20th anniversary of David Foster Wallace's Infinite Jest, The Year in Islamophobia, the story of the dark, neurotic adult coloring books of the 60s, and an article on how Charles Dickens secularized Christmas. To find all the goodies, go to lithub.com and sign up. Because we all need more stuff to read.
My thanks to Chico Enterprise Record book reviewer Dan Barnett. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.